Okay, this is a test of the overlap tape. Seems to be working.
By those who had hung on. And it seems to me you've got a very similar situation. Well, I don't want to flog that, but Bart, and then we'll come back to Tony and then Claude.
Just two things, and one relates to that. I agree with Charlie. You're not going to be able to do anything. I mean, in our village, we happen to have four families, but that's the way it is. And that same power structure applies not just to the corporations, but it applies, well, state corporations. It applies to the IRA corporation, and it applied probably before that to the traditional. Because even though the leader was thrown out, he was thrown out by the majority, because if the majority didn't want him thrown out, he wouldn't have been thrown out. He didn't throw himself out voluntarily. The question of who is discriminating, I think, is important. We're not going to be able to do anything about the people in the villages. I think there's one tendency, though, that's beginning, and that is that we ought to stop the federal government from discriminating on the basis of whether you're a shareholder or not. Some recent federal statutes have made that distinction, and I don't think that we should risk the status of a native with the federal government in a special relationship on the basis of whether he owns stock or not and has assets. So that status should be protected, and I think it could be if when we approach the federal government and ask for this ability to allow us to buy back, that we state specifically in there that even though the person sells, that does not affect his status as an American Indian under federal law. And that should at least stop, to the degree that we can, discrimination, but not discrimination amongst us, but discrimination by the federal government on that basis. The other point I wanted to address is I understand and I realize the restrictions on alienation, that they are deemed per se unreasonable when they're absolute, and that you usually need, Professor Fessler, a reason that's related to a corporate purpose. I submit that the federal government could make that alienation period absolute, based not on corporate purpose, but on federal plenary power, because ANCSA is Indian legislation. And so I don't think that we really, well, there may be an issue there, but I think that there is a clear out, at least with regard to absolute alienation of stock in ANCSA corporations due to the special relationship and the federal government's plenary power over Indians.
Maybe we could just have Claude, do you want to add anything, and then we'll come to Tony?
Just an observation, more. Well, I think my question was answered, but right now we do have two classes of natives already, those born before 1971 and those born after. I think it needs to be not discussed just here, but statewide by all corporations, just what are the destructive elements, if any, of that situation. ANCSA legislates the removal of the restrictions on the stock after 1991. Which will increase the separation of the two different natives, shareholders, non-shareholder. I can imagine going home and saying, "Oh, hello, how are you doing? Haven't seen you in a long time. Are you a shareholder? I'm a shareholder." People are going to be talking about that type of situation. And nobody's really looked at what destructive elements, if any, can come about because of that situation. If you want to have the corporations buy the stock, you can't do that after 1991 according to the law, but maybe in the interim there are other things that can be done. If the intent of the resolution is to provide for the elders, for example, to give them something before 1991, which is an honorable thing to do, there are possibly other ways that it could be looked at. I'm using the example of the New York Stock Exchange on the options market, the puts and the calls. A corporation may institute a contract between a shareholder and the corporation on a call type of situation where it gives the corporation the option to buy the stock at a certain set date or whatever the contract would say. It wouldn't actually buy the stock, but it would still have that shareholder have voting rights. He would still be a shareholder, yet the corporation has given the option or the money option to the shareholder and done the honorable thing for the elder, and it's not created the second class of native. That probably should be considered somewhere along the line also.
Just let me make one observation and then we'll go on to Dan. I think Claude's point and you all realize that I agree with them, is well taken, that the deep-seated consequences of this have to be considered. You've got two classes of shareholders now. You're going through a great big series of steps to try to get shares to the people that don't have them. Now, they happen to have been denied them because they weren't born in time. But at the same time, you're proposing that there be a buyback, an opportunity for corporations to make offers to the shareholders, and you could wind up with another division of people according to whether they hold shares or not. And in the villages, it may be more important than in the regions, because there it might, in the end, mean that they would be denied the use of corporate land, treated as trespassers. And that's one of the long-term consequences to be thought of. Well, Dan, you want to talk about subsistence, I can tell.
What I want to do is just to make one comment about these resolutions. I understood the point that you made, that they were drafted in a very general form and that you're going to work further on what they're doing. The only thing that I would say, I obviously, having just come here last evening from California, if I were to spend the rest of my life here, could not learn and become a source of judgment as to what is the best thing to do with respect to the human problems. As a lawyer, the only thing I do is draw your attention to some of these areas in the hope that however you word these resolutions, they will be drafted in such a manner as to minimize any ambiguity or leaving you open to lawsuits. Whether or not whatever the content is, just as a technician, I would hope that you would specifically interface with the state statute so that it is not a matter of speculation as to what was intended by Congress. And if the federal government chooses to speak out and characterize a permanent imposition of non-alienability on the stock as something which it is doing under its power to legislate with respect to the native population of the United States, then the resolution ought to say that emphatically and not leave it as a matter of speculation as to in what sense Congress was acting. These technical matters are ones that could be very important to you, because the last thing you want to come out of this with is to have to go back to Congress yet again and to mount this all over because you spent several hundred thousand dollars in litigation learning that it is worthwhile dotting the I's and crossing the T's when you're doing this type of thing.
Yeah. Tony, and then Glenn, and John, and Gary. And then we'll go on to the next resolution.
I've seen Glenn raising his hands for a while, and I think he wanted to respond to the earlier discussion, and I'm going to change the subject, I think.
I agree that when I go out to my villages and talk about 1991, they asked me, what if I sold my stock, right, if I had the right to sell it, where do I then fit? I say, I guess you're not native then, you know. Where can I hunt? Well, according to corporations, you just sold your stock and your land. You can't even by right go hunting because it's owned by these other people. And that's the kind of class we're gonna create in the long run, I think. That's why it's so important to me is to separate the land. That land would never be sold by some institution, you know. Who the hell cares whether I sell my stock? And that's what the natives are telling us. Hold that land. But the way the system is now, if I sold my stock, I sold my land rights. I can't hunt. And I think that's what they're saying to us, you know. And only way, as I see it, is to separate that land. If we have to go to Congress to do that, if we can't do it by state statutes, then we have to go to Congress. And I think that would solve our problems, you know.
Well, Glenn, I think later on the resolutions we're coming to come to grips with that. Well, you know that better than I do. It may be this discussion, which I found very helpful, is driving us towards your position. So maybe you can relax and wait till we all reach the point at which you've already arrived. John Taylor.
Tom, I think there may be another unintended consequence of some of these resolutions that we may want to explore a little, just so we know what we might be getting into. I think I'd like Dan to comment on it too, possibly. As I look at the possible impact of some of these resolutions, if they go through the natural chain of events, that they may have on village corporations. I suspicion that if we do make stock alienable in the village corporations, what we'll end up with is, out of the 50% that are left over, closely held corporations, very closely held corporations. And that brings about a whole new series of economic dynamics and corporate dynamics and, in some cases, legal dynamics. And I'm not so sure that closely held village corporations are really what you're after in the long run.
Gary, and then Elizabeth, I hope I'm right about this.
It's on.
Let me just add a footnote to what John said. In thinking through past experiences with regard to the termination of native land rights, we've seen various patterns affected with regard to per capita distributions versus tribal distributions. And there are pros and cons to both in terms of the probability of a certain proportion of people succeeding in economic terms. Per capita gives a higher probability simply because of the lack of concentration of capital. It seems to me that many of the resolutions that we're looking at give a very high degree of flexibility to individual corporations. That may be a strength, but it also may be a weakness. As an economist and as someone that studies the operation of markets with regard to the potential transfer of native corporations, what I'd like to see discussed more concretely is the process envisioned by which shares can be transferred or assigned back to the corporation. And in that, I think that there are impediments that can be built in to ensure that if the stock is going to be sold, that it will in fact receive a fair and just price, and that some of the worst case scenario effects are ameliorated. And there is another point that I would bring in with regard to the integrity of the village corporations and the importance of the land base to the subsistence rights of Alaska Natives. And that is, we're not looking at we're looking at interdependent, not independent situations. The development activities that will occur, instigated by certain regional and village corporations, will have a great deal of effect on the natural resource base on which people draw their livelihood. And it's potentially conceivable that you would have development activities occurring in mining and in other areas that would have a very sharp effect on the quality and quantity of game resources available for those people.
Yeah. Elizabeth and then Bart.
I know I'm repeating myself, but I do want to get in again that regions and villages do vary. And in Bristol Bay's case itself, we own only, or I guess, 98% of what we own is subsurface estate. There is no particular location of the region except the Bristol Bay area, but there's no, that division between native and non-native, those two classes, doesn't ring a bell for me for the region. Among our villages, in some of them, it rings a real bell that it should be of real concern. In some of the other villages,
do you mean native, non-native, or shareholder, non-shareholder?
Shareholder, non-shareholder. I'm sorry, shareholder, non-shareholder situation. In some of our villages, the movement of the population has already taken place. In effect, it's almost an abandoned village, and so the thought that there would be people there, living there, trying to utilize subsistence at the same time having sold their stock, doesn't ring a bell in those villages. While others, it would be a real problem. And I just stress the fact that fact patterns vary widely and would make a difference on whether that problem would occur. And the only other thing I wanted to mention ties in. Various people have talked about the value problem. As I understood it, when the resolution was initially discussed, there was some possibility of building into the statutory framework a formula for providing value. And I just want to caution that, and I think that's an excellent idea, and obviously in doing it there would be a variety of thought processes going through it, and it would be a formula that would apply so that, again, the management couldn't wing it and just offer people whatever they thought they could get away with. But something that looks very simple, like book value, is very appealing. The only problem with that is in many of the village corporations, the land has not been booked, or if it's been booked, it's been at $1 an acre. But I would further raise for you, what can you say the land is worth if it is committed for subsistence use and will not be used for something else, i.e. income producing, for 50 more years? What kind of, in economic terms, value do you want to assign to that, as opposed to the mythical and hypothetical corporation that Roland referred to yesterday, which is in a different position as to in economic terms of values of those lands. Lastly, I just wanted to say on value that even in the regional corporations, what's gone on in booking the land assets has varied wildly. For those of us who just have subsurface and have no, what is the proper phrase, known reserves, we have not booked anything. We're still in the exploratory stage. There's not one thing that will show up except in the footnotes. At the same time, you have a corporation such as Sea Alaska, which has valued and booked their timber assets. So all of that, in a variety of ways, has to be built in and understood in approaching appropriately a formula that would be fair both to the corporations and to the shareholders.
Yeah, Bart and then Tony.
Yes, just two things, and I understand the distinctions that Liz is making with regard to which shareholders still use land in subsistence use, which ones want to intensively develop. I'd hope that we make that a personal question that you ask either all of the residents or shareholders, whomever. You can't make presumptions just because someone has moved out. You make that distinction of urban rural, and it's not, people, even when they are in urban areas, still have lots of those interests that aren't always, simply moving to Dillingham or moving to Anchorage doesn't mean you automatically want to build the coal mine. So you have to look at it closer than that. The other thing I wanted to see if Mr. Taylor could develop, he said that he's concerned about village corporations becoming closely held. Well, I would say that most of our corporations are closely held already. So if you have some kind of fear there, I wish you and Professor Fessler, could develop that, because, I mean, I represent corporations with only 32 people in them. That's not exactly a public corporation. And even those like my own that has 300, there's five board members who essentially only represent, that represent the three major family blocks in that village already. So, I mean, I would say that we've got closely held corporations now. Is there something really to be concerned about? Or does that add to some dimension of what we're talking about here?
Well, I think the point being made is they'll become even more closely held. And when we've tried to deal with village corporations in helping them plan and in doing the kinds of things that they want to do, the more closely held they become, the greater the probability is that they either become extraordinarily flexible or extraordinarily inflexible. There's no medium road when you're trying to work with a closely held corporation. It either goes or it doesn't go, and that's the end of it right there. And so that's just one of the kinds of problems that I foresee. As you become even more closely held, that doesn't lend to the kind of flexibility an organization really needs to survive long-term cycles. Dan?
At the present time, Alaska corporation law does not know such a creature as a closely held corporation. Right. I mean, it's an unrecognized species. The new Model Business Corporation Act that has been widely discussed continues the non-recognition of closely held entities. The term closely held corporation is used, I think, in this meeting in a slightly different context than it is normally used or used in other discussions where we're talking about a situation where Liz and I wish to form a business that in all other respects would be a partnership, but what we would really like to have would be a heads we win and tails all our creditors lose situation, because we want limited liability, and so we form a corporation. We also wish to be given an indulgence wherein we don't have to observe any of the normal norms of a corporation. We don't want to have board meetings because it would be just the two of us. We don't want to have elections of the board because we would be voting for ourselves. And pretty soon you get to think, well, it's all being done with mirrors, and it's all sort of silly, and all we really wanted was limited liability. And so that is what many people think of when they're talking about closely held corporations. It poses for a state legislature a broad ethical problem as to whether they just want to sanction that type of behavior by people generally, as opposed to the notion that there are corporations that have a very few shareholders and in that sense are closely held. And what I think that is being articulated here is what we're talking about is a shrinking shareholder base. The more people who sell their shares to the corporation, what will a corporation do with the shares that it has acquired in this manner and may have had to part with hard assets in order to acquire? Well, it can't vote them. The directors can't vote the stock that's been reacquired. Theoretically, it can be reissued, which may be one way to handle the problem of those people born after 1971, the sort of pretermitted.
Excuse me, Dan. Leaving the people born after 1971 out, I don't think that it's contemplated that the shares could be reissued.
No.
You simply have a dwindling body of shareholders.
A dwindling body of shareholders, and therefore those individuals who have not sold out, to the extent that the assets still remain, are more and more firmly in control of those assets. And your point, and several others have raised, that they may be able to treat the assets, being the subsistence lands, as means of discriminating against other people, saying, well, you're not a native anymore, you can't hunt, et cetera. I mean, I can only begin to imagine the horror that would be brought about. But if you do, sir, take away the land, haven't you also taken away, and if the land can't be affected by the corporation, then the corporation has lost virtually all of its ability to have any disciplinary force upon the population or the area. Because if it can't determine what happens to the land, and that is the basic long-term concept of putting the land in present corporate title, not giving it to individuals, then you have that problem. What is the corporation for after that, if we succeeded in breaking off and saying that the land couldn't be sold by any institution?
May I answer that partly?
Sure. Well, Charlie.
The intention, I think, of Glenn's statement earlier is exactly what you've stated. To take out of control take the land out of control from the corporation, so that in fact, if the corporation's in trouble, for example, it really cannot utilize the land to bail itself out unless a group allows it, such as a traditional council or a cooperative or whatever that everybody would belong to. Now, in that specific issue, one of the real vigorous discussions we had in one of our retreats was the use of land by the remaining residents of villages. Kind of speaks to the point that Liz was bringing up about specific villages, some that have a lot of the remaining stockholders still there, others that have a small percentage, and a lot of them live in Dillingham or Anchorage or wherever. Now, one of the concepts that we threw out at that or threw it onto the table, I mean, at one of the retreats, was that can we place some restrictions on determination of land use, such as that if the land is to be utilized, sold, or whatever, that those that are still remaining on the land will be the determining ones. Of course, we got into a real vigorous and discussion on that. And that was kind of aimed at the point that you just brought up and what Glenn has been bringing up, that in fact taking the land out of the corporation was exactly the point that you're bringing up, is to take it out of control of the corporation, really.
And you want the corporation left.
Maybe. It may be that it would survive and be involved in some activities. For example, I know Glenn's corporation is involved in real estate here and other things. But see, the problem is with the land being an asset of that corporation, if their activities here get in trouble, I mean, it jeopardizes also the land that's held by the corporation, and
most
that
surely
is exactly
it does.
The point.
Yeah. And if shareholders, qua shareholders, though they're no longer residing in the village and they're no longer leading the traditional life, have a voice, they may obligate the corporate land for enterprise purposes that are antithetical to the people who remain, such as having
that's
the
correct.
Big coal mine there. That's
correct.
A separate and distinct issue, because it might be financially successful and culturally ruinous.
Yeah, I think we should go to Tony. I think what I've
wanted to add into the discussion, or at least bring to the attention of the commission, is a couple of points that really seem to be I never hear it discussed on any statewide level, but it's a real problem to individuals, and that is during the registration process to become shareholders in the corporation. The process in which persons could designate themselves as members of a particular village or members of a regional corporation left a lot of people very confused. Some people were living outside of the state of Alaska, going to school, and when they filled in their form, this humongous sheet that they had to fill out to become a member, they put down an address which made them to be shareholders either at the regional level or in another village, simply because when they put down their current mailing address, they put down where they were at rather than at home, where home was. So people who are, for instance, who have been raised in the village of Klukwan are not shareholders of Klukwan Incorporated. They're shareholders of Gold Belt, they're shareholders of the 13th Regional Corporation, they're shareholders of Sea Alaska at large, and have not been aware of any provisions to become shareholders of the village in which they live in. That goes directly to some of the issues that we were talking about earlier, is you're not a shareholder. What are you doing? What are you talking about? You don't belong here. You're not a shareholder. Why are you living in this village? So, and it does present that kind of difficulty. And then the other issue that was presented by the Claim Settlement Act was the definition of what a village is. There were at least two villages in Southeast Alaska who wanted to receive the status of village corporations. They wanted to be able to incorporate a village corporation and receive the benefits of the Claim Settlement Act. And they were denied that right by definitions within the Claim Settlement Act. One is whether or not that particular group of people are natives any longer, or whether there's a village there. Certainly the village in Haines, there's a village down on the waterfront. It had been there all of my life. And you know, there's stories that go on forever, including current people who live there. And they call themselves a particular tribe, and they applied for status under the Claim Settlement Act to become a corporation and to receive benefits, the 23,040 acres, and they were denied that because under the Claim Settlement Act it said there was a provision in it that said that the corporation or the community had to maintain some kind of integrity as a native community. Also, because of that definition, they were administratively denied the benefits of the Claim Settlement Act and are now holders at large, shareholders at large in the regional corporation. And they don't, I mean, the basic community has been affected by it. And then another village in Southeast Alaska, where it had been a traditional village, applied for status, and they had a minimum of 25 people who had applied and everything, but they were denied as well the ability to participate in the act as a village and develop a village corporation. So I think that I'd like to, I don't know where this fits into this discussion on these resolutions, but it is a problem that was raised by the Claim Settlement Act. It's a somewhat of a 1991 problem because it's part of the Claim Settlement Act problems.
Yes, David Case and then Bart.
Just to sort of amplify what Tony just said, I think there are probably, frankly, four village communities that I can think of in Southeast that sort of fit that bill, and but Ketchikan is the obvious urban area that is a continuing, there's some continuing frustration there, I think, with having been excluded from the act. But there are other communities as well where there's the issue comes up. And I think maybe Seward and Valdez, maybe others. And indeed, this may be an issue that, and although I know that it's been said that there will be no more land and no more money, I guess the question ought to be asked, is it possible at this, even at this late date, to correct what seem to be injustices?
Bart and then Charlie.
Just one other thing to hopefully to keep it hooked into this idea of being able to buy back stock and how does that affect control and whatnot. There's an irony here in that one of the earliest proposed reasons for keeping settlement vehicle, a corporation, was to ensure the right to be mobile but still be able to participate in the decisions of what happens in the local area with regard to land use, so that if you were a shareholder and you could participate in a corporate body that could be anywhere and yet still own lands in a particular place, that allowed natives then to move to Nome, to Barrow, to Fairbanks, a local area, and yet still be able to participate in the decisions about their homelands. Like Tony said, that same criteria wasn't afforded to the process of determining who would get claims. If you were mobile before, that usually meant that you lost status. So that if you're mobile after, that's fine, that's what we want, but if you're mobile before, you lose. I am in the process of fighting for one just like that, and before I was with Seward, with a small group. But, and the other thing is, that's fine. I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Charlie, you have the floor. You make your observations and then go on to the next resolution.
Okay. First couple of observations. You know, ANCSA is replete with these horror stories about the enrollment process, and I think one of the things we don't address in the resolutions but has been brought up, and you've probably heard it in your travels, and I hear it occasionally with my own stockholders, look, I'm enrolled, somebody will say, I'm enrolled in Sitnasauk, and I really should be enrolled in Shaktulik. Will we be able to go back to where I really should be enrolled after 1991? We don't address this yet. I don't know yet how we're going to do that. But it's certainly one that needs to be addressed, not only in the context that Tony has brought up, but in fact of transferring from really where you feel you should be and where you are registered. And in fact, I was living in Oregon at the time of the process of enrollment, and luckily I put down my home village as my mailing address. My father, who was visiting me, put down that his mailing address currently was Portland, so he ended up in the 13th. And unfortunately he died before he could he could get that corrected. So I'm now have inherited shares in the 13th as well as my home village. But I mean, the stories about that are endless, and perhaps in some point we can correct that with some of these resolutions. I'd like to introduce the next three resolutions kind of because they're all related. I'm not going to be here this afternoon, so I'm going to ask Glenn and Marlene to lead the discussions on land. The next resolution, 04, is intended to allow the inclusion of newborns that were born after 1971 and allow some special provisions to the elders by issuing them additional stock of preferred stock or change stock of some kind. The resolution 05 is a resolution that would prohibit the transfer of stock to non-natives, and perhaps while it doesn't specify it, a use of the method that Tony has suggested of life membership, or I can't remember the term you used, Tony, but something life estate stock or something like that might be a way to implement that particular resolution. Resolution 06 would allow the corporations to extend the benefits of voting and other benefits to those that are descendants of natives. Now, there's an important assumption in both 04 and 06, and that is that the agreement reached in 7I applies after, you know, irregardless of the number of people that would be included in any future expansion of the corporations. As I mentioned earlier, the 7I agreement that we've reached between regions freezes the level of distribution percentages at the original enrollment numbers, so that if I'm receiving income from Bering Straits or funds from Cook Inlet or Sea Alaska, irregardless of how many stockholders they have in the future, my percentage of a little over 8% is not going to be affected. We got into a very vigorous argument about that again in discussing the amount of the blood quantum of those that should be included. And when we finally got to the point that it doesn't make any difference to Bering Straits how many shareholders Koniag has or Aleuts or Bristol Bay, because it's not going to affect any revenues I get from 7I, then it's not going to affect us, period, if in fact Koniag allows those that are 3/16ths or 1/8th to participate in their corporation. It's not going to have any effect on us at Bering Straits. And neither would any changes in our enrollment have any effect on other corporations. And that, I think, we finally reached an agreement on the blood quantum level. If it wasn't going to affect us, you know, between corporations, that it doesn't make any difference then the level of blood quantum that is required for participation. And so going back to the 104, the resolution, I'll read it. Be it resolved that the Alaska Federation of Natives and Convention Assembles endorses the concept that ANCSA should be amended to give each corporation the option of offering additional stock to natives, leaving the price, if any, up to the corporation and eliminating any liability for issuing stock at low or no cost. One of the arguments that we got into that's obvious is that by issuing additional stock at low or no cost, we're decreasing the value of those that are currently stockholders or diluting their value. The counter argument to that we got into was, what right or what did we do as current stockholders to benefit, to receive this benefit of owning stock? What did we do any different than those that were born after 1971? The only difference is the date. And the argument is that our land has been held for us by our forefathers for generation after generation, and a continuing process that we should not eliminate in one generation by this 1971 deadline, that are those born after 71 have as much right being born native as we do to participate in the land and the benefits of that land. That's how we the two arguments that came here. The settling argument on that is the one that I mentioned, that it's not going to affect between regions the numbers, since we've frozen the participation percentage of any revenues from 7I. So one of the, I might add though, before everybody gets into the discussion is this, for I think us, we that are in native corporations at AFN, perhaps the real benefit here of this discussion is the amount of legal expertise and advice that we're getting at little or no cost.
It's worth
every penny. Well, I think we can look on that as a compliment. I think Glenn and Gary wanted to say something about this.
Discussing that, what would happen if we know that we want to tie 7I to the existing shareholders. what will happen then if we all, I mean, eventually die off and no more 7i? I mean, is that the idea? It would do that, wouldn't
no,
it?
No, the intention of freezing the 7i participation percentages at the original numbers is like, for example, Bering Straits receives a little over 8% of 7i revenues of the whole group. Of all Alaska Natives. Now, we're going to receive that according to the 7i agreement, irregardless of our numbers after that, because you know our numbers have swollen from 6,300 shareholders to like something like 7,100, and it's because of the inheritance when somebody dies and they got 8 kids or whatever. Okay. So our actual numbers have increased, but the number of shares we have is still the same. And it was the intention at the 7i negotiations that we freeze it at that level. That was kind of an understanding that there wouldn't be at any, or there might not be any expansion of the actual numbers of shares. There might be an expansion of the number of participants.
Gary and then Elizabeth.
A question regarding the distribution of stock to people born after 1971. Do you envision this to be a continuing process? And if so, what kinds of criteria are going to be used? And the second point is, I have some difficulty understanding this because I think it's a very controversial one with regard to the effect on the magnets of control. You know, there's a very strong tendency, I think the literature bears this out, for private corporations to become more public over time, and by creating either different classifications of stock or reissuing the same kinds of stock to new shareholders, you're enlarging that stock base.
Okay. You know, we had a lot of discussion on that very same question, and some suggestions were brought up, such as the one that Tony put out, was that a life membership or a life estate type of stock that would revert back to the corporation or would die with the person when they died would be the way that we would go. It would be similar to a membership in a tribe. I mean, the tribal membership is not something that you can dispose of. And the discussion about including those born after 71 was similar to that concept. Now, granted, it needs a lot of work, and it needs some real paring down and definition. But that was the intention, not so much to continually develop a widening base of stock. If we did that, I mean, we'd have how many hundred millions of shares at some point. The intention was that to develop some kind of stock, like the life estate stock that Tony has mentioned, or something similar to that. In one of the other resolutions, we ask for the ability to transfer assets to a related Native organization where life memberships would be given out that were non-transferable. So those maybe should be tied together, and that discussion should also apply this afternoon when the discussion on the transfer of assets to a tribe or an IRA or a co-op or whatever type of organization is set up.
Elizabeth and then Tony.
Charlie, I just had two questions for a point of clarification. First of all, you mentioned that you're going to draft so that 7i isn't affected. I assume you also mean that you'll draft so 7j isn't affected, so that as village corporations do or do not enlarge their shareholder populations, their percentages too would be remain set.
Yes, when we speak of 7i, we also generally include 7j.
Okay, good. And the second question I just had, to make sure that I understood this, on the new native, whether or not a corporation issues stock to new natives is optional. Is that correct?
That's correct. And in fact, all of the resolutions here are options rather than mandates.
Yeah. Tony and then Bart.
Thank you. The other question, something that was brought up to me, and I guess a lot of us have have been asked of this question before, but it's not a part of the discussion yet, is what about those older natives who would be new natives had they registered to become shareholders, but by some reason they didn't register. They're natives, or they meet the blood quantum requirements, and somehow they didn't get registered by 1972 or 73 when the cutoff date was. They're not participants in the Claim Settlement Act, and these resolutions don't address that. And I was wondering if there was going to be some method for getting those people to become shareholders.
Yeah, in our discussions on this particular resolution 04, there were three classes of people, or I guess we can call them classes of natives, I guess now. Those that were born after 1971, those that did not register for some reason, no matter what reason, and the elders. And the intention was here to include those three groups of natives that we felt needed to be, and everybody has felt needed to be included in the land claims benefits.
Thank you.
Bart?
Yes, just a couple of questions, and pointing out some things. I don't like ringing my own bell, but this discussion, the conflict that you're having here then is whether we want to continue with the typical kind of distribution of assets under a corporate system with private property rights as the basis, versus how much, you know, that conflicts with our idea of sharing the assets and distributing out to everyone. I don't think that we ought to look at it. I mean, we can say that we'll have either or. We'll either have pure distribution or under corporate law, private property, or else we're going to spread it out to everyone. There are places in between, and what we're talking about is what kind of different distribution systems can we have so that we all participate and still feel like a community. I mean, there's, and Professor Fessler and some other corporate people may be able to talk about the idea of making different classes of stock so that, well, right now under corporate law, you've got preferred and common shares.